Of all the sad things in the human race today, maybe one of the saddest is that it's increasingly thought, you know, on just a sort of a street level sense, that there's no meaning in life to be discovered. And there's nothing out there that's transcendent that would somehow make cohere all the various aspects of what it means to be human. There's no real meaning of life out there to be discovered. There's just that I might be able to eke out through that which I consume or experience. And of course, one of the issues with this among many is that the idea of consuming and keeping distracted through experiences will save me. That is to say, it will make me feel kind of essentially human or good or right or fulfilled or whatever that might be. But save us from what? Boredom? Low self-esteem? I mean, in what way are we saving ourselves through consuming and experiencing? Or what are we saving ourselves for? And of course, you know, the traditional, really deep commitment of Americans, and I was just reading another essay about this last night, Happenstance, you know, the big, sort of powerful drive of Americans has always been freedom. And thankfully, of course, we are free. You're free to drive, and you can take your car wherever you want, and you're free to fly, and hopefully the airplane goes where you want to go, and, you know, you're free to walk. But it leaves somewhere deep in our conscience, the front of our minds, the question, where? But where am I going? Yeah, I have this freedom to motor about, but where am I going? And why? And I think most importantly, who taught you that? Where did you learn that that was fundamental to being human? Who's your teacher for what it means to do life? Because life without core meaning, life without trying to find some transcendent meaning, pushes us to all kinds of destructive paces. It stirs up all kinds of intensities in us. It leaves us adrift with no deep orienting commitments. We're just left with our preferences. Well, I'd prefer the plane go to Phoenix today because it's warm there. Or I'd prefer the plane go to New Orleans because it's fun there. So we're just left with our preferences, which are really just, and I hope you hear this, for many of us, if not most of us, our preferences are simply little indicators, dashboard indicators of the present disordered state of our desires and appetites. And so then those desires and appetites begin to push us towards, you know, living out some sort of preference and living out our freedom. But as you know, those of you who are from Holy Trinity, know I'm a raging Jesus freak and just think he's stunningly brilliant and an amazing leader. And this is one of the moments where we get to see him being an amazing leader, when he answers the question about what are the most important aspects of humanity in the image of God. What does it really mean to be human in the image of God? And he says there is, of course, meaning to human life, and that there is a God-given life worth living. That is to say, there is a good life out there. And he says it's comprised in being salt and light, which flows from a true inner goodness. Now, there's lots that we could talk about in this passage this morning, and I've chosen just these two. What does it mean to be salt and light? And to do so in a way that transcends the apparent righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. How do we be salt and light from true inner goodness? All right, ready to go? For my whole life, I have desperately, maybe even neurotically, wanted to be salt and light. I had this image just captured me from a 19-year-old kid. And in some form or another, the thought has never been far from my mind. But in the last 20 years, I have discovered and continually battled this thought. You can't be light when your life is going at the speed of light. It's impossible. You might find moments of it. But salt and light requires a certain presence. Light has to be present to whatever it's illuminating, Salt has to be present to whatever it's preserving or whatever. It requires a kind of presence. And so, you know, one of our most famous thinkers about this, Henry Nouwen, has said, then he thought that the task of ministers was to help people to concentrate on the real but often hidden events of God's active presence in our lives. So Nouwen spent a good part of his life wondering about this one question: how can we keep people from being so busy that they're no longer alert to God? You see how this is beginning to work? You can't really be salt and light unless one is alert to God and what God's doing. Now, if we think of Jesus as a classic model, his life, of course, was full, very full, but he was never in a hurry. And what you see in Jesus is something like what you see in a great musician on stage or something. You see a relaxed but focused concentration on the present. And if you don't hear anything else I hear this morning, you need to hear this stunning thought. Jesus invites you to take on that easy yoke and that light burden. I mean, are you feeling me here? He invites you to take his kind of life into yours, such that you could too have a very rich and full life. But never be in a hurry, never be at a pace in which you lose that sense of his easy yoke and light burden. So then that, of course, raises another sort of stunning thought. What if our real work as human beings, no matter what we might get paid for, what if our real work is to apprentice ourselves to Jesus so that we learn to be his way of being salt and light and truly righteous in this world, with a righteousness that exceeds that of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Well, if this is so, then this means we need to learn how to pause, how to create rhythms in our life that allow us to notice God, to pay attention to ourselves and to the people and events of our lives. And that, by the way, is why we practice that here in church at Holy Trinity. I mean, yes, it's one thing to say that our sort of aesthetical values for worship are thoughtfulness, quiet, and beauty, but that quiet piece doesn't sit there as a mere aesthetical value for worship. It sits there as a training device, as a spiritual practice. So in a moment, when Tony leads us in the confession, there will be a time of quiet. Well, not merely to execute on an ascetical value, but to teach us to take out of this room ways of pausing and noticing, being alert to God and others in our lives. So again, Jesus, you know, the great teacher on the meaning of life, says to this hill full of normal people, remember, we're still on the hill here, the sermon on the hill, the talk on the hill, when Jesus is still explicating or explaining this stuff about the kingdom of God. So this great teacher on the meaning of life says to a bunch of normal people, unimportant in the eyes of the world, we might call them Palestinian peasants. He says to them, a way that I like the way Eugene gets this in the message, let me tell you why you're here. So picture Jesus looking at this hill full of people. He says, let me tell you why you're here. You're here to be salt seasoning that brings out the God flavors of this earth. You're here to be light, bringing out the God colors of this world. And I was looking at that again, you know, several times during the week this week, and the thought came to my mind, like, really? Was Peter sitting there? He doesn't seem very full of light. I wonder if the sons of thunder were on the hill that day, James and John, who wanted to call down fire from heaven. I wonder if Judas was sitting there, or Martha, or Mary Magdalene, or Nicodemus. And he says to them, and again, I have to apologize for the Greek lesson, but this is one of those times where it's very important, because Jesus is not saying in future tense, someday when the kingdom's consummated, you will be salt and light. And it's not a command. This is not written in the imperative in the Greek. This is not something in like shaming their past, like, well, you dunces were supposed to be salt and light, and God created you into this great nation, and you've totally blown it. This is a simple statement of fact. In the Greek, this is second person plural. That's easy, you, right? Present indicative. That means here's what's right now true about you. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. It is a very simple Very straightforward statement of fact. But I know we have a hard time hearing this, at least I do, because I know my struggles. And this week I just happened to be in a store somewhere, I don't know, hearing sort of elevator music, and I asked somebody, what is that song? Because it was so captivating. So I understand this is by an artist called India RE, which some of you may know. I'd never heard of her. I don't know how orthodox her faith is, but in this case, it doesn't really matter. She gets the verb, the Greek verb, when Jesus says you are, it's a form of the verb emi, which means it's the basic Greek to be. And so when Jesus says you are, it's that he's just saying this is what's true about you. So she writes, I am light. I am not the things my family did. I am not the voices in my head. I am not the pieces of the brokenness inside. I am light. I am not the mistakes that I have made or any of the things that caused me pain. I am not the pieces of the dream I left behind. I am light. I am not the color of my eyes. I am not the skin on the outside. I am not my age. I am not my race. I am light. So whatever her theology might be, orthodox or not, I don't actually know. But she gets this. She gets the notion of to be. Well, Jesus says, if you're actually going to do this, you have to find your way to a life that's characterized by something really important. That is that your righteousness, your sense of being in goodness in the world, exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, it's important to quickly say here that Jesus is not down on the law. In fact, in our passage, he said that he came to fulfill it, and that whoever did and taught the law was great in the kingdom of God. But the scribes and the Pharisees, though being the best people of their day, it's so important that you hold that in your mind. They were thought to be the best people of their times, so much so that they had taken the law of Moses and broke it into 248 commandments, best we can tell, and 364 prohibitions. And they literally tried their best to live that out. Can you even try to fathom that? I mean, I have a hard time stopping at stop signs, right? Because I'm so impatient. They had literally, they were, you know, going on 700 things that they had memorized and were trying to keep. And it had led to this horrible kind of externalism. So when Jesus says, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, it's important that you hear that he's advocating for a difference in kind, not in a difference of degree. He's not saying, well, if you would just make it 249 commandments, or if you could get to 370 prohibitions, then you'd all be good. No, he's not advocating for a difference in degree. He's advocating for a difference in kind, going from externals to an actual changed heart. Because core to the real stuff of salt and light are inner qualities like compassion and love. And these come from a changed heart, not from external rule keeping. Are you tracking with me here? So this is how Jesus, I think, puts these two things together. So that then it requires us to learn to be present to ourselves before we can really be present and salt and light to others. And this of course, was the burden of De Caussade and his little book that some of you probably read, The Sacrament of the Present Moment. The whole burden of that book is, how is God being mediated to me right now as I stand here and speak? And how is God mediating you to me, and me to you, and God to you? De Caussade's whole project, so to speak, in that book was to teach us to learn to be present in such a way that we are salt and light, and that we're not mediated to each other by our keeping of the law, Jesus would say, but by the grace and power of God that makes us present to each other and to him. Julian of Norwich, wrestling with this same sort of thing, was asked someday, well, how do you do this? I mean, you're so good at this. How do you actually stay present to God and to others? And she answered, I look at God, I look at you, and I look at God. And that grounds me into a different kind of life. And that's what I'm shooting for. It's what we're shooting for here. We do not do beauty for the fun of it. We do not do intelligence for the fun of it. We do not do quiet for the fun of it. We do it to try to assist our souls. These are spiritual practices to assist our souls in a different kind of life. So I don't know about you, but I need it. Because sometimes I find myself failing to embrace my own vision. Like, how nutty is that? You know, maybe I need a little medication or something, right? Are you feeling me here? I mean, sometimes I find mission or vision drift in my own heart and own mind because the world, the zeitgeist, this present evil age is so busy, it's so magnetic, it's so in our faces that you easily lose any sense of being grounded. It's like there's monsters in me that crowd my inner life and too often govern me. You know, self-important needs to achieve. Or this one's often in my mind, to leave a legacy. Or to fix everything wrong in the world. And so if you relate to any of this, then you'll know that what happens then is we begin to devalue non-productive times. But if Jesus really is our master, if he really is our leader, if he really is the one through whom we're learning to be human in the image of God, then according to him, core to life in the kingdom is peace. Go in peace, Jesus said. Be at peace. I've come to guide your feet into the way of peace. Peace be with you. My peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. In me you will have peace. And we could go on in that vein. So to Jesus, again, if we find him intelligent and competent to teach us about a new and different kind of way of life, then he thought quarter it was peace. Well, just try pulling that off in an academic system when you're supposed to publish, right? And the anxiety to publish, or if you're a minister, as several people in the room are here this morning, to grow a church or to have something intelligent to say on Sunday mornings, it's a big task. And all these things they drive us out of any sense of being groundedness in the life that Jesus invites us to. But again, I find in myself often a hate for limitations of all kinds. I don't like to be limited in energy or limited in intelligence. I don't like limitations of any kind, including Sabbaths of various kinds. Keeping it real here? Including Sabbaths of various kinds, whether those are daily or weekly or, you know, quarterly, monthly kinds of things. Because I have this need to prove myself worthy to be alive. And that's your choice. Prove it. Prove to Jesus that you're worthy of taking your next breath, or except from him, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. That's the constant internal battle. So Marva Dawn, in her book, Keeping Sabbath, she, of course, was writing about the real Sabbath, but let's just think here of rests of various kinds. Dawn says that Sabbaths transform us so that we can more deeply value others. For when we're not under the compulsion to be productive, we're given the time, and I would add the inner space, to dwell with others and to really be with them. So just as we go into our little time of quiet now, I want to try to help you think through a bit practically so that this isn't just a conceptual sort of talk. So in order to be salt and light, while simultaneously avoiding the externalisms of the scribes and the Pharisees, but being salt and light from an interior change of heart, how can we, you know, we're all going to get up out of here in a few minutes and go do our life. How do we do it? Here's a couple of thoughts. First of all, stop beating yourself up. Stop thinking that I'm just a little candlelight and, you know, other people are big, you know, neon signs. That doesn't go anywhere. Second of all, don't walk out of here and try to run a spiritual marathon or climb a spiritual Everest. Don't make this another thing to do, some big task to be salt and light. But here I think this is a really good little spiritual practical tip. You know what I wish you'd do? Is ask yourself, where and when do I already find myself being present? Just stop for a moment today and this week and ask yourself, where are the times when I am kind of intuitively, organically more present to my life than less? And start with that, and then just build on that. Little by little, build trust in God, trust on yourself. Just do the next right thing in the category in which you're already pretty good at, and you'll find through the power of the Holy Spirit, the grace of God, the shepherding of our holy text, the encouragement of a spiritual community, you will find yourself little by little moving in the direction. But, and this is so crucial to the pace and intensity stuff, that we would do it with Jesus's little modest objectives in mind. A little salt. A little light, a mustard seed, a little bit of yeast, that it would just come into your life and utterly transform it. That you would not strive, but you would be salt and light.